Well, besides the obvious fact that this is a much more happy ending than King Lear.
Absolutely.
To a very, very similar kind of motif. I want to first say just a little thing about the siblings and then move into something, Eleanor, that I would like to hear you expound on a little bit. So first, just as for the siblings, this tale presents something that happens often in fairy tales. It's a sort of three-way split. The very, very familiar motif of three sisters. Many tales have this or three brothers as the pattern. And in relating to the siblings in this kind of tale, we're taking up a theme of sibling rivalry. We can either see the siblings as being related to the parents. The first two siblings typically are more related to the parental expectations, the outer world's expectations of what they should value. And the youngest sibling is usually either completely lost in that world and appears like a dumbling, in fact, or, as this sister, really takes the question to heart, thinks about something like what love means, and finds it to be a relationship that enhances the experience of both. And she uses here the image of food and salt together, enhancing each other. So the first two daughters here are apparently competing with each other, and the last daughter is really relating directly to her love for her father. But I think I want to leave that theme, because more recently I've been thinking about this tale in relation to your book, and that brought up the theme of the dual mother for me. So Jung speaks of this motif of the dual mother, and he speaks of it in Volume 5 of the collected works, which is titled Symbols of Transformation. We experience that really mysterious maternal source, which is the dual mother, when we're reborn into our individual lives, when we begin the individuation process. According to that theory, in our early lives, we're very bound to the parents, to siblings, to the whole family influence in our psychological development. But as we move through adulthood, we begin a process of self-exploration. Sometimes it's due to a natural tendency towards reflection on our own lives, our inner lives. And at other times, it's because it's been thrust upon us. Through life circumstances, a trauma maybe, early loss, or the midlife crisis.
Right.
In reading your book, I became intrigued by the idea that a step-parent can be an early concrete experience for a child of the dual mother or of the dual father. It seems to me that the kind of insights that you present and the kind of mindfulness that your book encourages would really pave the way towards this possibility. And I'm wondering if that's off base or if this is a concept that you see as well.
Exactly. I certainly see that. There are a couple of themes, and I love this fairy tale, by the way. I think the first two daughters are probably early ways that we express love, what we get, who buys us what. That third daughter, the final stage of what does love mean to me, what does it make for my life, is a much more complicated thing. We certainly have an image of a narcissistic tendency in the father to want to hear what he wants to hear and not really listening, which I think many, many people feel that their own parents at times have not heard how they loved them, have not heard what they needed. The second mother in this fairy tale, the old witch or the old wise old woman, certainly would be a wonderful image for a stepmother, of somebody who can, when the original family constellation is fracturing. You don't have a divorce here, but you do have this image of two different mothers, one much wiser and more willing to both take in when needed, understand, and accept the child as she is, but also doesn't seem to need that kind of reflection back. This is a stepmother who's not asking, you know, what do you mean to me? What do I mean to you? It is a way of keeping both innocence, but also making the child do some work. I think that's often where many of us in our own dual mother with our biological mother get hooked into all of a sudden the unconditionality of being loved by a mother who demands nothing, which I guess is maybe our earliest experiences of love has suddenly got all kinds of conditions from, I guess Freud was right, toilet training starts. After that I go more Jungian, but stepmothers have a conditionality. They don't have that unconditional regard. They're bereft of that biological connection, but they can be wonderful in terms of preparing a child for the outer world, for the, you know, what the rest of the world will accept. We don't get unconditional love from most of society. They've got all kinds of conditions about proper behavior and providing, you know, a living. We don't have that sense ever again. I think everybody longs for it and sometimes tries to put it into, I want to be loved unconditionally by a romantic partner, not that they'll ever give that to anyone. This is a wonderful story of probably the best potential for spiritual development, for growing, for becoming an adult by somebody who makes you work but cares about you and protects you and keeps your innocence, but also makes tremendous demands that you not just get by on what you look like. I think the mask is interesting.
Not only not get by on what she looks like, but she has to hide that side of herself.
Yeah, which I think, you know, many, certainly I've worked with women who've been models, and often there's a harm in being allowed to or encouraged to, sometimes by parents, to just be okay if you're really, really pretty or if you're really good at something or you really excel, and then not sort of do the internal work of what's underneath that. What if I didn't have that skill or that appearance? I love this fairy tale.
You just referred to the inner work, and I'm thinking of one thing I like about this second mother, the witch, is that she has at least two. Actually, it seems there are three kinds of work that the girl does. The outer work with the geese, and she has to do that daily, and it's hard, rough work.
Yes.
And then she does this other work in the home, spinning, and apparently she's been taught very well because she moves nimbly with that. We see just a glimpse of it. But the two that I was thinking of was actually the outer with the geese, and then this moment when she says to the girl, now go do your work. And she goes further away from the home. She goes to this well, and she becomes the girl that she was, and she begins to weep. And it seems as though there's an encouragement to be yourself, to be your individual self, to live your process fully, that this second mother can give the girl. And the first mother, we don't know a lot about her, except that she appears to have been not very effective.
Yes.
So perhaps passive.
Yes.
As a mother.
And the first mother describes, you know, all this physical appearance and all these wonderful gifts, but not, and I love it, that doing your work was good, to go to a well, to go to the deeper parts of your life, to go in the dark, in the unconscious. And that's the real work of life, which is, and the stepmother is the guide for that. And I think that often is true if you have a really caring stepmother. She doesn't try to be the biological mother. It is not a competition between two women who can mothers who. They have very, very different tasks. And they can, you know, the stepmother doesn't try to, you know, usurp the mother's role. When the mother comes back and is the child is more developed, she vanishes.
Right.
And my chapter on Merlin has that same quality.
Exactly. Merlin has that same kind of role.
I come when I'm needed, and when I'm no longer needed, I can back off and let the other connections work for you. The other part I find funny, since I always tend to go, how do we work with these fairy tales? Because sometimes they have such an objective, you know, concrete reality. You know, the first 3 years of a step-parenting relationship are often the test, and just in step relationships very often survive if they can survive the first 3 years. have a better life expectancy than first marriages, partly because there is so much work to be done.
And that fits with the symbolic, very, very frequent symbolic view of the number three, that it's the number at which movement
exactly.
can take place. Once the third year has finished, has been completed, in this case, we've got something that we can move into more solidly,
exactly.
so to speak.